From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. There's one question we've been returning to again and again, because impeachment trials have happened only 3 times in U.S. history. And that question is, what is the long-term meaning of this one? Beyond Donald Trump, or Adam Schiff, or Mitch McConnell, what is the lasting impact of this impeachment? How will it change the shape of our democracy? Well, one way to get at that question is through the lens of national security. So let's listen back to House Judiciary Chairman Democrat Jerry Nadler back in December as he announced the articles of impeachment against the president.
Our president holds the ultimate public trust. When he betrays that trust and puts himself before country, he endangers the Constitution, he endangers our democracy, and he endangers our national security.
That is the thrust of the first article of impeachment, the charge of abuse of power. Quote, President Trump used the powers of the presidency in a manner that compromised the national security of the United States. End quote. So is that what's really at stake here? A redefinition of presidential power and U.S. national security? This hour on Point, we'll explore that, impeachment and the security of the United States. And we're joined by a terrific panel today. First of all, Barbara McQuaid. She is a law professor at the University of Michigan. She previously served as U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, and she also served as Deputy Chief of the National Security Unit in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Detroit for more than a dozen years. She joins us today from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Barbara McQuaid, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Meghna. Delighted to be with you.
Also with us today is Susan Hennessy. She's the executive editor of Lawfare and previously served as an attorney in the Office of General Counsel at the National Security Agency. She's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, and that's where she joins us from today. Susan Hennessy, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Susan, let me just start with you. Is the question of a threat to national security one of the things that makes this impeachment different from the other two in U.S. history?
I think it does. And I think clearly this sort of this national security concern goes to the core of why the House felt compelled to pursue impeachment over this and not over a past sort of misconduct in the Trump administration. We actually saw sort of the turning point of support for impeachment was whenever a number of new members of the House of Representatives who were from sort of purple districts coming out and saying, we have national security backgrounds and we feel that the president has now compromised the security of the United States. We should be clear that whenever we're talking about what is at issue in the impeachment being a national security threat, that's distinct from disagreeing about policy. Mm-hmm. So it's one thing to say we don't believe, we don't believe that the president has, the appropriate policy regarding the extent to which the United States should be supporting Ukraine in its conflict against Russia. That's one thing, and that's something that we ordinarily don't think of within sort of the rubric of impeachment, but really just sort of policy disagreements and differences. Yeah. But what we're talking about here is actually the subversion by a president of a stated U.S. policy, of a policy endorsed by his own administration, and appearing to use the powers of his office not actually to achieve any policy goal at all, certainly not a policy goal related to the national interests of the United States, but instead personal political favors. Mm-hmm. And I think that really is why we're here right now.
So, Barbara, do you think that in the impeachment trial proceedings we've heard so far, both in the case laid out by the House managers and now the president's defense counsel, is this question of national security actually being lost a little bit?
I don't know that we have focused enough on it. I think if I have one complaint about the presentations by both the House managers and the defense is that their opening arguments have been far too long. Hmm. I think that you risk distracting the fact finder, the Senate, and the public that they serve the more you talk, because then there are a lot of things that people can point to and say, you know, this is all about Joe Biden. This is all about Hunter Biden. And I think in a more succinct presentation, there would be the focus and emphasis on national security. But as Susan says, that is the thing that likely convinced those who were reluctant to wade into impeachment initially with regard to the Mueller investigation to convince them that this was worthy of impeachment. Because, just as prosecutors use discretion and don't charge a defendant every time a crime is committed. You know, you don't charge every case of jaywalking or littering. You use your resources they're scarce, and so you use them judiciously. And removal from office is an extraordinary remedy that should come into play only for very egregious misconduct. And here, that national security betrayal is what makes it worthy of removal from office. And I do think that the more you talk about other things and other factors, the more that message can get diluted.
Mm. Well, so as you both know, of course, that alleged betrayal is laid out very clearly in the first article of impeachment. But I want to hear a little bit about how the House managers talked about this question of national security as they laid out their case. So here's Adam Schiff talking about the withholding of U.S. aid from Ukraine and the national security implications of that. And he also asserted that the president bought into Russian propaganda and that that had serious consequences. So here's what Adam Schiff said last Thursday.
I mean, when we ask about, okay, what's the national security implication of what the president did? How much more clear can it be that he's not only pushing Russian propaganda, that he's not only misleading Americans about who interfered in the last election, that he's not only doing the Kremlin a favor, but that he's withholding aid from a nation at war? The Russians not only got him to deflect blame from their interference in our democracy, but they got him to withhold military aid.
House Manager Adam Schiff last week. Susan Hennessy, deconstruct that comment from Adam Schiff a little bit. Somehow I hear that he's bringing Russia into this, which might be sort of an umbrella issue here. But did Democrats make a mistake here by pulling Russia into what would otherwise be a very easily definable set of actions that the president made regarding Ukraine?
I would imagine that Congressman Schiff is mentioning Russia part in sort of an allusion to, the Mueller investigation and, of course, longstanding concerns about this president and the motivations of this particular presidency. I don't know that it particularly muddies the water. This is already a rather complex story. So what the president was seeking investigations, what's conditioning, essentially, according to the testimony and documents we've seen thus far, was conditioning military aid on a number of investigations. So one of these investigations was into his political opponent, Joe Biden, and his family. That's relatively easy to understand. Another one of these investigations was into essentially a debunked conspiracy theory that boiled down to the idea that it was Ukraine and not Russia that had been responsible for the 2016 election interference. Again, that's contrary to the position of the U.S. intelligence community. All of Trump's own administration officials have come forward and said, no, they agree with the intelligence community. Russia did, in fact, interfere in the 2016 election. And, of course, this has been a sore spot for the president, who perceives this as sort of a knock on his legitimacy. And so this conspiracy theory, this debunked theory that reportedly has origins in Russian propaganda, that this company CrowdStrike had somehow become involved in the hacking, and that was that is what the president wanted the Ukrainians to actually investigate. And so it's yet another example of the president pursuing his own personal political interests. But it also is a demonstration of the extent to which sort of conspiracy theory and foreign influence appears to lead the United States president to take concrete actions, and that is something that we should be extremely alarmed about.
Okay, so Barbara, then let me just piggybacking off what Susan said, let me just turn the question a little more directly, okay? For people listening, what should they understand? I mean, how would you define, in your mind, what the national security threat is posed by the actions of the President of the United States?
I think there are a number of national security threats that arise from his conduct. First, looking at the request for activity, an announcement of investigations that would interfere with our elections. We have statutes on the books that make it a crime for anyone to solicit a thing of value in connection with an election from a foreign national or a foreign government. And that's because we want Americans deciding American elections. When foreign actors and foreign governments get involved in elections, they are not acting in our best interest. They're acting in their best interest. So that's one. Foreign involvement in our election upsets the democratic process. The other is when a president asks for a favor from a foreign government and keeps that a secret, that is grounds for blackmail. When you apply for a security clearance in the intelligence community, one of the things they ask you and one of the things they ask everyone you know, all of your friends and their friends, is there anything that could be used to blackmail this person if they're in a position of holding the nation's secrets? And if President Trump has done something untoward and the government of Ukraine knows about that, he has now compromised his ability to lead this country as president. That is also significant. And then with regard to the military aid, Ukraine is an ally fighting a war with Russia. And by withholding that aid for several months, people no doubt lost their lives in Ukraine. And I know that Mike Pompeo allegedly said the other day that, do you think any Americans care about Ukraine? Well, if they don't, they should. And ultimately, caring about Ukraine comes to the doorstep of all of us in the United States. As Representative Jason Crow said during his argument, we are helping Ukraine fight Russia there so that we don't have to fight Russia here. Ukraine is the gateway to Europe from Russia, and allowing that Russian aggression to continue unchecked makes our allies in Europe unsafe, as well as us here in the United States.
Well, we are talking this hour about looking through the national security lens at the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump and this bigger question about how these impeachment proceedings might redefine or reshape our concept of national security and the power of the presidency. So we want to know what your question is about that long-term impact. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the long-term national security implications of the impeachment of President Donald Trump, really that bigger question about presidential power and national security. I'm joined today by Susan Hennessy. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and executive editor at Lawfare, and she previously served as an attorney in the Office of General Counsel at the National Security Agency. Barbara McQuaid also joins us. She's a law professor at the University of Michigan, formerly assistant U.S. attorney in Detroit for 12 years, serving as deputy chief of the National Security Unit. Now, Barbara and Susan, you both very sort of meticulously laid out, as you see it, the threats that were posed by President Trump's behavior vis-a-vis Ukraine. But of course, his defense team has a very strong response to each one of those allegations. So I just want to play a little bit from what one of President Trump's lawyers told the Senate. So here's Eric Hirschman responding to the House manager's case. He spoke before the Senate during the trial on Monday.
The House managers would have the American people believe that there is a threat, an imminent threat to the national security of our country, for which the president must be removed immediately from the highest office in the land. Because what? Because he had a phone call with a foreign leader and discussed corruption? Because he paused for a short period of time, giving away our tax dollars to a foreign country? That is their theory. It is absurd on its face. Not one American life was in jeopardy or lost by the short delay, and they know it.
That's one of the president's legal team, Eric Hirschman, speaking to the Senate on Monday. So, Susan Hennessy, several things within there. You've heard it before. I mean, the president and his supporters have repeatedly said that his actions were completely normal in the context of the presidency, a phone call to a foreign leader, a temporary pause in foreign aid, and that looked at it from that way. It's absurd, as Hirschman said. It's absurd to consider this a threat to national security. Your response?
You know, I'm not sure that the president's attorneys, we can even credit them with truly believing the argument that they're making. Because, of course, nobody here is suggesting that the president of the United States wasn't allowed to have a conversation with a foreign leader. No one was suggesting that he didn't have the limited power to freeze foreign aid in a number of circumstances. The issue here is why he did it and the motivations and whether or not he was being motivated in the actual national interest or not. And so, for example, you know, prior presidents have held up aid. They do so after and with the consent of Congress, right? They inform Congress about what they're doing and why. They openly take that position and recognize a co-equal branch's role in defining U.S. national security policy. Whenever we talk about sort of the imminence of this threat, you know, first of all, I think many Americans would take issue with the notion that the only thing that matters to our national security is American lives rather than the lives of our allies. Additionally, you know, whenever we think about it, as Barbara mentioned earlier in the broadcast, the integrity of U.S. elections. You know, one thing that is really astonishing about sort of the allegations at the heart of the impeachment inquiry is how close the president came to getting away with it. That had the Ukrainians actually announced this investigation into Joe Biden, into Hunter Biden, at this point, we would all be having a conversation about those investigations. The media sort of would have been off and running, and it would have been almost impossible to disentangle how exactly this all got started in the first place. And so the core of the allegation here is not that the president froze military aid. It's that the president froze military aid in order to extort a foreign leader into becoming an opposition researcher for his upcoming political campaign. That the president of the United States used the foreign policy powers of his office to request a foreign country undertake an investigation of a U.S. citizen absent a valid criminal predicate. These are core, these really are go to the very heart of how we think about potential abuses of office. And so, you know, the idea that this would be absurd on its face, you know, I think that really just doesn't pass the smell test. Mm. This is what impeachment was designed for. And frankly, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say these allegations are among the most serious presidential misconduct that has ever been alleged in the history of the American presidency. And it's foolish to minimize that.
Well, and also we should note that the General Accounting Office fairly recently found that the Office of Management and Budget did violate U.S. law in withholding that aid from or delaying the aid to Ukraine. So there's sort of an official imprimatur on part of your argument there, Susan. But Barbara, I think the thing that I keep coming back to that I struggle with is I hear what both of you are saying, and yet there are still many Americans out there who look at the president's actions and see his actions as normal within the context of a presidency. And the threat that they see is the threat of Congress preventing a president from being able to do his job. I mean, what would you say to those listeners who are listening right now?
What Eric Hirschman did in that segment that you played and what members of the public are hearing is a common defense tactic, which is to isolate certain aspects of the president's conduct and say, look at that. That's not a crime. You hear defense attorneys do this all the time in a trial. And of course, isolated acts are not. It is the totality of the circumstances. And jurors are instructed to use their common sense to draw reasonable inferences from the totality of the circumstances. But two things they're trying to isolate. One is the call. That the call is the whole thing. That's all the president did. The call itself is problematic where he asks for a favor, but certainly that is not the totality of the case. You have to look at the months of negotiations that occurred with Gordon Sondland, with Rudy Giuliani, with Kurt Volker. In fact, that very morning before the call, Kurt Volker has a text message exchange with an aide to President Zelensky in Ukraine where he says, you got to get Trump to you got to promise President Trump you're going to do the investigations. That should be his goal in this call. And so we know that there's far more than just this call. So by isolating focus on the call, Eric Hirschman and the defense team is trying to isolate one single piece of evidence to try to say that there's nothing wrong with that. The other is this brief pause on the aide and that it ultimately flowed. So no harm, no foul. But it is the demand that was the harm. Bribery and extortion are what is referred to in the law as an inchoate crime. That means it is complete upon the demand. Even if the condition is never satisfied, it's the demand that does the harm. When President Trump demanded a corrupt favor, he did some very damaging things to our country. He harmed our reliability as an ally around the world that we fulfill our promises. When we say we're going to give you aid, we give you that aid. And so it harms our credibility on the national stage. The other thing it does is harms our credibility as a corruption fighter. The Department of Justice has programs all around the world to promote the rule of law in emerging democracies. We teach prosecutors how to fight corruption. If we ourselves are engaged in corruption, we have completely shot ourselves in the foot in our ability to be successful there. So I would suggest look at the big picture, not isolated incidents. And when you see defense attorneys doing that, call them out.
We're trying to understand the long-term implications for U.S. national security within the context of the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. Again, we're at 800-423-8255. Let's go to Eric, who's calling from Kettering, Ohio. Eric, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. Speaking of the big picture, you know, somebody had said something earlier about, like, that it was a tough – that Congress is having a tough time showing this – it's comically clear what happened with the call, but showing it through a national security lens. But I mean, the big picture is that Congress has given so much power to the president for 100+ years now, and they're really going to have to work at it to get that power back. It might not happen under a Democratic Congress with a Republican president. It could be vice versa. And so there'll be political things going on there, but it's just going to be tough. Like everybody knows, to show this sort of election interference type of thing with national security. Because I mean, one could say, like going back, I mean, even to the 1930s, where presidents would say, "I don't know if I want to do this or that," as it pertains to national security and a potential election, because I want to be able to do this or that. And that impacts lives. Whereas, you know, so some people might be more responsive to that in 2020 and say, "Hey, oh, I see that.
Right.
That's national security." But with an election, they just don't. And then to my knowledge, they're, you know, things were hacked and they're
right.
You
know, it's harder to see to connect the dots, to see the constellation for what it is. Eric, thank you so much for your call. Susan Hennessy, do you want to respond to that? I mean, Eric seems to be heading in the direction of saying that we being the United States, has consolidated power in the executive so much over the past many decades that perhaps it was inevitable that we got to this point.
Yes, I think Erica is certainly being descriptively accurate in both terms of the migration of presidential power and the migration of power from Congress to the president over time. It's also true that our founders understood they were creating an astonishingly empowered executive. They debated it and they understood the risks of abuse. And so they set a counterbalance, and the counterbalance to having an executive that was empowered and thus was able to act decisively and in a manner that could preserve national interests was that when the president used those authorities to harm the national interest or to not act in the national interest, the remedy was to impeach him and remove him from office. And so the system that we're seeing playing out right now is the system of Congress setting bounds. And so there's a lot of focus on whether or not the president is ultimately going to be convicted or acquitted. But I think people should keep in mind that in the history of the United States, States, a quote-unquote failed impeachment is the history of impeachment, mm-hmm. impeachment without removal, and that prior impeachment have served to set really important boundaries around executive power by having Congress make this very, very strong statement. This is unacceptable conduct. This is impeachable conduct. That's not just a message to this president. It's also a message to future presidents.
Yeah. But Susan, if I may ask, you said a little earlier that, yes, perhaps other presidents had, I'm paraphrasing here, and correct me if I'm wrong, but perhaps other presidents had, had done things before that might have seemed on the surface of them not in the interests of the United States. I mean, I'm trying to think about maybe we should sort of more thoroughly interrogate what we mean when we say the national security of the United States, because was President Reagan's involvement in Iran-Contra operating against the national security interests of the United States? Was President George W. Bush starting a war, invading Iraq, which we're still, we're still bogged down there almost 20 years later? Was that in opposition to the national security interests of the United States? And if so, how were those two actions, just random examples, I'm sure we could come up with one in the Obama administration, concretely different than what President Trump has done?
Yeah, so I think those are actually pretty good examples because they are examples of presidents pursuing policy goals that large numbers of people disagree with. But there's no – right, so lots of people believe that George W. Bush was wrong, and he's certainly been proven wrong through history in beginning the second Iraq War. Certainly, Ronald Reagan, sort of his involvement in Iran-Contra, although there are significant questions to this day about sort of his personal knowledge of what mm-hmm. was happening. These are not moments of glory in presidential history, but neither of those presidents were impeached for that. And that's because we ordinarily don't impeach for policy differences. We don't even impeach for maladministration, right? This idea that the president did a bad job and screwed up something. We impeach for actual abuse, when the president is pursuing something that he understands to not be in the national interest. And I think that's why whenever we look at President Trump's conduct and the conduct that we oversaw, what we are talking about is something that is fundamentally different than what we've seen before, not just in sort of the later cover-ups, which of course became sort of the more significant elements of prior presidential scandals, not the crime but the cover-up. In this particular instance, it's both the crime and the cover-up. It's that the initial impulse here was to set these really awesome powers of the commander-in-chief and the American executive to, as Fiona Hill described it, a domestic political errand. And that's something that is fundamentally unprecedented in American history.
Barbara McQuaid, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think that Susan raises a really great point, and I hear this from time to time with people I talk with who pay only a little bit of attention to what's going on with impeachment, that I think it would be a mistake to impeach and remove a president over policy differences, and that is absolutely not what this is about. Mm. This is about corruption. This is about a president who is abusing his power for personal political gain. If he decided that he wanted to cease to be an ally with Ukraine because he just thought that was in the best interests of American national security, I might disagree with it, but he has the power to do that. What he was doing was leveraging military aid that had been approved by Congress so that he could extort a personal political favor. And as you mentioned, in the wake of Watergate, one of the laws that was passed as a reform measure to address the issue that Eric raised in his phone call about Congress ceding power to the president was to reclaim some of that power and to say that if Congress authorizes the expenditure of funds, because Congress under the Constitution has the power of the purse, if the executive does not fulfill its duty by executing that order to make payment on something, that is a violation of the law. And so as you said, Government Accountability Office has determined that the law was violated. That law was violated, the Impoundment Control Act, when the president paused that military aid and delayed the delivery of that. And so I think that's an effort by Congress to reclaim some of that power. And I think, as Susan says, it's important that Congress have some consequence for the president when he abuses that power and violates the law. And so the impeachment alone is an important step to say, we're going to call you out on that. We are not going to permit that. We're not going to sit on our rights and allow you to run roughshod over it and take over that and fill that vacuum. But I also think that the Senate has an obligation now to fulfill its duty and vote to remove the president and not simply say, well, it's enough. We've had our little impeachment exercise, wag our finger at the president and move on. I think to really reclaim that power, the Senate has a higher duty than to its party, but the senators have a duty to the institution of the Senate to reclaim that power.
Mm. Well, we are talking this hour about national security and the impeachment of President Trump and really the bigger question of presidential power and how it is influential, incredibly influential in what we consider to be efforts regarding our national security. I'm talking with Barbara McQuaid and Susan Hennessy today. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about national security and the impeachment of President Donald Trump. I'm joined today by Barbara McQuaid. She's a law professor at the University of Michigan and former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. Susan Hennessy also joins us. She's executive editor at Lawfare and author of the new book, Unmaking the Presidency, Donald Trump's War on the World's Most Powerful Office. Let's go to Mike, who's calling from Wausau, Wisconsin. Mike, you're on the air.
Hello, I have two quick questions. And the first question is, the point was made on the program that this delay in the aid may have cost Ukrainians their lives. And my question is, during the 8 years of the Obama administration when lethal aid was withheld, would that have cost Ukrainian lives? And then my second question is, the point was made that withholding this aid could have created a danger of Russia invading Ukraine as a doorway into Europe and endangered our European allies. And my question is, does anybody think that Russia is going to invade Europe, especially related to the withholding of this aid? Thank you.
Well, Mike, thank you for your call. I'd note that Russia has already invaded Crimea. But Susan Hennessy, I think you're the one who was making that point. So do you want to respond to Mike about his assertion that, quote unquote, the withholding of aid during the Obama administration may have cost Ukrainian lives as well?
Yes, I think this is actually a really important point. So, of course, the Obama administration didn't freeze aid. What the Obama administration did was openly adopted a policy position of not supplying Ukrainians, of supplying the Ukrainians only with non-lethal aid. So this was a controversial policy. It was something that was debated at the time. The Obama administration was required to articulate and defend the proposition of why it thought that this was the manner in which it should be supporting Ukraine and it shouldn't be offering this sort of additional support of supplying lethal support. And its answer was essentially they were trying to tamp down on a cycle of escalation that they think would have ultimately led to additional sort of risk for the United States. So, again, that's in the category of policy difference, right? So people can disagree. They can disagree over the best way to defend Ukrainian interests, to defend European interests, and to defend American interests. The difference also, of course, is taking a policy position openly and transparently versus taking one in secret. And what happened here is actually the Trump administration formally adopted one policy and then behind the scenes was secretly and outside of official government channels pursuing an alternative policy. And that actually leads to significant and new forms of harm. So it's one thing for the United States to say this is the form of support we're going to provide and keeping their word, and no matter where the level of that might be set. On the other hand, if the United States says that they are going to be supporting Ukraine and then fails to do so, right, fails to deliver on its word, what that does is really raises questions about the degree of our commitment to our allies and our partners. And that's the kind of thing that has more significant long-term consequences. You know, as you mentioned, the Russians have, in fact, invaded Ukraine and are currently occupying Crimea. This notion of territorial sovereignty, that it is not acceptable for other countries to seize land by force, this is a core fundamental principle to sort of the modern liberal order and an order that the United States is deeply invested in preserving. And so, you know, while I think that there's certainly legitimate concerns to litigate over the Obama administration's policy towards Ukraine, I think it would be a really significant mistake to confuse that by suggesting somehow what Donald Trump has done here is not fundamentally different, far more harmful, and represents an abuse of office in a way we have not seen in prior administrations.
Well, I want to take a step back here for a moment and really sort of keep picking at this question of the long-term implications for U.S. national security, regardless of how of the final outcome of the trial that's currently going on in the Senate. In order to do that, let's just step back in time all the way back to last November, which seems like 100 years ago, I know, but it was only a couple of months ago, because I want to play for both of you a series of moments from the long chain of testimony that we heard from several key members of the diplomatic and national security establishment in the United States. So first of all, here is William Taylor, the top diplomat to Ukraine. He testified before the House Intelligence Committee on November 13th. And you'll recall that in his opening statement, he described what he called the irregular policy channel that was led by Rudy Giuliani, the president's private attorney. And he also talked about a chain of events that led Taylor to a meeting with National Security Council officials and on a particular conference call when Taylor was told that that additional security assistance to Ukraine was being withheld until further notice.
All that the OMB staff person said was that the directive had come from the president to the chief of staff to OMB. In an instant, I realized that one of the key pillars of our strong support for Ukraine was threatened. The irregular policy channel was running contrary to the goals of longstanding U.S. policy.
So that's Bill Taylor talking about an irregular policy channel. Now, on November 21st, Dr. Fiona Hill testified again before the House Intelligence Committee about her time as National Security Council director. She talked about her clashes with Ambassador Gordon Sondland, and she said that during Sondland's testimony before the committee, she had realized that many of those confrontations were born from her not actually understanding what Sondland was being asked to do.
But it struck me one yesterday when you put up on the screen Ambassador Sondland's emails and who was on these emails, and he said, these are the people who need to know that he was absolutely right, because he was being involved in a domestic political errand, and we were being involved in national security foreign policy, and those two things had just diverged. So he was correct, and I had not put my finger on that at the moment, but I was irritated with him and angry with him that he wasn't fully coordinating. And I did say to him, Ambassador Sondland, Gordon, I think this is all going to blow up, and here we are.
Dr. Fiona Hill on November 21st. Now, on November 19th, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman also testified before the Intelligence Committee, and he told the committee that he had reported his concerns about the president's July 25th call with the Ukrainian president and that he did so out of a sense of duty.
My intent was to raise these concerns because they had significant national security implications for our country. I never thought that I'd be sitting here testifying in front of this committee and the American public about my actions. When I reported my concerns, my only thought was to act properly and to carry out my duty.
Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman on November 19th. Now, Barbara McQuaid, the reason why I wanted to play all those sort of back-to-back is you hear those phrases, domestic political errand, irregular channel, concern about national security here. I wonder, are we at the point where, regardless of what happens in terms of a verdict in the impeachment trial of President Trump, are we already at a point where it won't be impossible to imagine a future where U.S. national security policy is driven by something other than what's in the best interest of the United States?
That's a terrifying proposition, because we elect a president to be the commander-in-chief of our armed forces, to lead the executive branch of our government for the very purpose of doing what's in the best interest of the United States, to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. If there is one public channel of diplomacy that's being done by our State Department officials, and then some irregular channel that's being done by lawyers that the president hires privately to benefit his own personal political interests or some other agenda, then, as Adam Schiff said, all is lost. We are all in this together. We're a government of, by, and for the people. We rely on democracy and transparency to understand what it is that we're doing collectively as a country. The president is there to serve the people. He is not there to serve himself. And so this is the kind of testimony, I think, that is so important to highlight, in contrast to the single call that Trump's defense team wants to focus on, because this is the harm. This is the harm to our national security when our diplomats, State Department, Defense Department is working on one agenda that is publicly shared, and when the president is working on a different, secret, private agenda. That is when there is an abuse of office that is impeachable and removable.
But Barbara, you know what I – Susan, I'll come back to you in a second. But Barbara, you know what I also hear in listening to all that tape back to back to back with Vindman, Taylor, Hill, amongst others? We have the highest level folks in our diplomatic and national security infrastructure, being concerned about the president's actions. And they're at the heart of this policy, making the enacting of the policy. And yet it still happened, right? I mean, the president did withhold the aid. The president, now we're hearing, according to John Bolton, linked that specifically to a request for the Ukrainians to investigate Joe Biden. Did you see what I'm getting at? Like, shouldn't we be talking about perhaps there's some fundamental frailties in our national security and diplomatic infrastructure that allowed this to so easily happen?
Yes, and perhaps after this is all done, one of the things that Congress wants to explore is whether there needs to be more perhaps congressional oversight to see what's going on, so that they can have an understanding of whether people are abusing their power. But at the end of the day, Magna, all of these government jobs rely on people doing what they're supposed to do. And if they don't, that's why we have consequences like criminal prosecution for certain people, firing and discipline for others, and in the case of the president, impeachment and removal.
Well, Susan, so let me just turn that to you, because I'm going to pick at this a little more. Again, from viewing it from the outside, from the layperson's view, it does seem to me that what we're looking at here is the possibility that all it takes is for a very industrious private lawyer to the president and a couple of well-picked ambassadors for a president to very easily subvert, if I can use that term, what's in the best interest of U.S. national security. That seems to be a very low bar to clear.
Yeah, and I think focusing on this question of irregular channels and really explaining why that is such a concern, it's important to understanding how we safeguard national security interests. So why does it matter whether or not the president of the United States is going through the State Department or going through his private attorney, Rudy Giuliani or Lev Parnas or others? It's because government employees who work in the national security space adhere to a series of ethics rules. They have to engage in conflicts disclosures, financial financial disclosures, a thorough interrogation of whether or not there are any areas in which there might be influence over their decisions or choices that are not in the national interest. That is very, very carefully vetted. And one thing we're seeing play out in real time with respect to Mr. Giuliani, Mr. Parnas, and others is that these individuals appear to have, at the same time as having been carrying out Donald Trump's private political agenda, also appear to have potentially been carrying out their own financial agendas, were working for other individuals, including other foreign interests. And so it really does allow some insight into why there should be such concern for this process irregularity. Now, the President of the United States is entitled to go outside the ordinary process. He is the head of a unitary executive branch, and the job of the executive branch and the State Department is in essence to do what the president wants. The reason why the president felt compelled, or the likely reason why the president felt compelled to go outside of this channel, is not because he couldn't direct them to, for example, to freeze aid as he did, but because those channels are designed to facilitate congressional oversight, to ask questions on behalf of the nation, and to comply with laws that are designed to ensure that the policies being carried out on behalf of the United States are being done in a lawful and transparent manner so that we, the American public, and in limited circumstances, Congress on our behalf, can make a full assessment and decide whether or not we want to hold the president or the executive branch accountable, either through congressional oversight, in extreme cases, things like impeachment, but also just whenever we go to the polls and we decide whether or not to reelect someone as president. Mm-hmm. This is all crucial, critical information. I think it's a really vivid sort of illustration of why these processes matter and really go to our core national security interests.
Well, so Susan, is that one of the fundamental things that's at stake here, is the possibility, as we finish up this impeachment trial, of the affirming of the legality of irregularity in the office of the presidency?
Yeah, I think one of the risks is that what had long been believed to be the fundamental check on this is that if the president did something like this, if in fact he used and abused this discretion and this flexibility that's inherent in the office in order to pursue his own political gains and goals, that he would pay a price for that, right? Or he or she would pay a price, either in the form of impeachment or in not being reelected. And so I do think that what we're seeing right now is Trump is proposing that this is a legitimate way to use the powers of his office. He's not apologizing. He's saying this was a perfect phone call. This is a valid use of presidential power. And so what we're at risk of right now is, first, the United States Senate acquitting the president along partisan lines and thus ratifying that behavior as acceptable to the United States Senate. And I do think that really tees up the question for the 2020 election of, do we want to ratify this use of power or not? Because the way the American people decide if something is acceptable is when they cast their votes. And if Donald Trump is reelected, that will be a significant expression by the American people that we are okay with this. And that's something that not just Donald Trump for the second term, but future presidents will learn from. And it's something we should take very seriously.
Well, Susan Hennessy is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. She's executive editor of Lawfare, previously served as an attorney in the Office of General Counsel of the National Security Agency, and author of Unmaking the Presidency, Donald Trump's War on the World's Most Powerful Office. Susan, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Barbara McQuaid, law professor at the University of Michigan, former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, and also served as assistant U.S. attorney in Detroit for a dozen years as deputy chief of the National Security Unit. Barbara, it's always a pleasure to have you. Thank you so very much.
Thanks, Meghna. Great to be with you and Susan.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.